Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. From the crack of dawn this morning and even before, the eyes of the nation on Washington, D.C. Watching the sun come up on the Capitol Dome, spilling across the West Portico, where Barack Obama will at noon be sworn in as President of the United States. And on across the Great Mall, teeming today with a huge crowd, a crowd so big it may be history in itself. Here are some of their voices.
Even though we're freezing to death, this is just a fabulous moment for all of us.
And this voice from the crowd.
As being an African-American male, I'm very, very, very excited. But now I'm even more excited that this is something that everyone is becoming a part of.
Today, we tune in with the nation and much of the world to Washington and the great gathering for the inauguration of the 44th President of the United States. This hour on Point, an historic inauguration day for Barack Hussein Obama. You can join the conversation. What are your thoughts, your emotions on this day? Did you think you would ever live to see it? With me in the studio, On Point News analyst Jack Beattie. Good morning, Jack.
Good morning.
And with us, distinguished historian and Princeton University professor emerita, our friend Nell Irvin Painter. Nell Irvin Painter, thank you so much for being here.
Hello, Tom. Thank you.
Nell, first, just your emotion at this moment on this day.
Well, I have been so overcome. I live in Newark, so I watched the run-up on my computer, actually, and scanning the people in the audience and seeing their emotion and seeing how many different kinds of people were there, different ages, families, that just, I'm almost in tears just thinking about it.
Let's go right to the excitement building on the streets of Washington. Jerry Seib is executive Washington editor of the Wall Street Journal, and today he's our color commentary man. Jerry, thank you very much for being with us. Give us a sense of the Capitol life swirling around you today.
Well, it's an amazing sight. It's sort of a very cold, open-air carnival atmosphere, I guess I would say, and what you see are buses and people more than anything else. I'm about four blocks from the Capitol now and have been downtown since about 7 a.m., and you just see streams of people heading toward the mall and buses everywhere from all over the country. A lot of people have taken up empty space along the route. I'm in a car still heading toward the Capitol. Lots of entrepreneurs have set up shop selling every conceivable kind of Barack Obama memorabilia, Barack Obama hand puppets, Barack Obama buttons, Barack Obama shirts, sweatshirts, hoods, everything you can imagine. So it is a very un-Washington-like atmosphere, I guess I would say.
The whole world watching, really, as that mall fills up from the Capitol portico right down across its great sweep past the Washington Mall and around the Reflecting Pool and Lincoln Memorial. 1.2 million, the biggest crowd in history in 1965 to witness Lyndon Johnson's inaugural. What are you hearing, Jerry, about the crowd there today and what it may amount to?
Well, people talk in terms of 2 million. I was a little skeptical in the days leading up to Inauguration Day, thinking that maybe all of the talk about security perimeters and traffic problems might have scared people away, but it doesn't feel that way now. I mean, it feels as if everybody who we thought was going to descend on Washington today actually has descended on Washington. So I don't know. It's hard to do crowd estimates except from a helicopter on a day like this, but you get the feel that there are lots of people here and not very many have been scared away.
And the mood, Jerry, a mood of openness to a new day. It's easy to be giddy on an inauguration day, especially such a historic one. But the Capitol has been watching this president-elect move toward this moment at noon. What's the mood?
Well, you know, it's hard to generalize, and you can probably overread a mood on a day like this, but you do see a lot of smiles. You do see a lot of happiness. I saw on the subway ride in to downtown that I took, you saw people doing something I rarely see people do on the Washington subway, which is taking pictures of each other as they rode in, you know, just because even that mundane part of the day they seem to want to capture. And,
that's wonderful. So
just to be there, just to record this day and have a little digital readout, say, January 20th, 2009, maybe.
Yeah, I think that's right, and you see people doing that on street corners as well. You know, digital phones out taking each other's pictures, and you know, there's nothing in particular in those pictures except each other, and you know, the sense that I was there. So, and I'm, you know, I'm now looking at the Capitol, and there are just people lining both sides of the street. So it's and we're, you know, we're not within a security cordon around the actual inaugural. So some of these people, I suspect, are yet to try to make their way into there, and some of them will probably be disappointed. But they're all sort of living the moment, I guess.
An oceanic crowd gathered there in Washington. Jerry Seib, Approaching History, with us, executive Washington editor of the Wall Street Journal, co-author of Pennsylvania Avenue Profiles and Backroom Power. Jerry, thanks very much for being with us.
Happy to be here. Thanks.
Jack Beatty, your thoughts as you look on?
Well, I've been rereading Barack Obama's books, and at the back of The Audacity of Hope, his 2006 book, he tells that in the Senate, when he'd be feeling bored and things were not going well, he would jog down the mall, sometimes just to the Washington Monument, but sometimes all the way to the Lincoln Memorial. And he said when he was there, he thought of all the faceless, nameless men and women, slaves and soldiers and tailors and butchers, constructing lives for themselves and their children and grandchildren, brick by brick, rail by rail, calloused hand by calloused hand, to fill in the landscape of our collective dreams. It is that process, he says, I wish to be a part of. My heart is filled with love for this country. Barack Obama.
In his own words. Wow. Nell Irvin Painter, here we are, this day rich in so many dimensions, and the racial dimension not least of all. And looking here at your biography, Nell, you,
yes,
born in Houston, Texas, at the Houston Hospital for Negroes.
That's the place.
And here we are today, 2009. I mean, are, yes, you one of those saying, I can't believe this is happening in my lifetime?
Yeah, I kind of am. I'm getting used to it. I got used to it after Barack Obama was elected. But when I talked to you right after the election, I said I had never thought that this would happen in my lifetime. It's obviously happening. It's very exciting. But, you know, I want to point out one thing about,
yes,
race. Mm. We scholars, we historians often say, you know, race is a concept. It's not a biological thing. But we generally tend to think of it as a biological thing. Well, this event should lay that to rest,
yes,
once and for all, because Barack Obama has no biological connection to the history that we've been seeing paraded before us so happily, and rightly so.
Of the slavery, the slaves sold on that mall, the slaves who helped build that capital.
Yeah, the segregation, mm-hmm, all that. That is American history, and he is an American, and this is a victory for all of it. This is a victory for black people, and it's a victory for non-black people.
A man elected, you might say, on the basis of the content of his character.
Well, he was also elected because of this symbolic connection to, mm-hmm, our racial history.
Mm-hmm.
We shouldn't forget that. That's really important. But to be connected to that racial history has not called for biology or blood or Southernness even.
Mm-hmm. A bigger view of race right there on this day as the whole world watches Washington, D.C. and this enormous crowd gathered now before the Capitol, stretching literally miles down that mall. Joining us now from Washington is Ron Brownstein, political director for Atlantic Media, publishers of The Atlantic, The National Journal, and The Hotline, author of The Second Civil War, How Extreme Partisanship Has Paralyzed Washington and Polarized America. He joins us from the NPR studios in Washington. Ron, thanks very much for being here.
Hey, Tom.
Give us a sense of what you've seen today in the Capitol on your way to the NPR studios.
Well, very much as Jerry Seib described, incredible crowds moving down toward the mall and as well as the parade route. Lots of people on the metro and everyone in extraordinary good spirits. You know, this is, you know, I kind of often thought 8 years in which much of blue America, to begin with, has felt extremely alienated from Bush. I mean, this has been a period in which those who did not support the president were not lukewarm about him. They felt deeply estranged from him. And as I've been going to events all weekend, there's this extraordinary sense of reconnection for many of the supporters of Obama, who I think did feel deeply alienated. And I find myself wondering if Obama had not won in these circumstances that were existent in the country, how deep the alienation on the other side of the coin would have been in those kind of blue parts of America. But in fact, there was a big majority built. And you see it, as Jerry said, kind of reflected in it. I mean, Obama did win with a broader coalition than Democrats have been able to assemble in quite some time, only the second Democrat since World War II to get past 50.1% of the vote. And you see that manifest here today in the diversity of the crowds that have gathered for him.
We have seen this morning Barack Obama and his wife, soon-to-be First Lady Michelle Obama, headed into the White House, standing at the front door with the Bushes for the traditional coffee there. A rather gracious handoff from George W. Bush and Laura Bush to this incoming president, it would appear, Ron.
Personally, very gracious, and President Bush has been that way all the way through in his personal dealings with the other party. And yet the bequest that he really leaves Obama is striking in two respects. Obviously, the magnitude of the problems, but at the same time, President Bush, as he was in the campaign, is an important tailwind for Barack Obama. As Stephen Skowronek, who's a terrific political scientist at Yale, has pointed out, the presidents who've made the most impact in kind of reshaping our political landscape, whether it's Lincoln in 1860 or Roosevelt in 32 or Ronald Reagan in 1980, all followed presidents that were widely repudiated by the country. It gives you a lot of running room when people feel that the road we're on has reached a dead end. And there's, you know, one poll number really struck me over this last week as he takes office. It was an ABC Washington Post poll. When Bush took office in 2001, 47% of Americans said he had a mandate to make major changes in our social and economic policy. For Barack Obama, that number is 71%.
Wow.
And the sense that we need a new direction is very broad-based, I think, and provides a tremendous amount of leverage for Obama to move forward on an agenda that is very ambitious and will reshape the federal government if he moves just this very first bill that he's talking about.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We are covering the inauguration day of Barack Obama, about to become 44th President of the United States. You hear the sound there from the Mall in Washington, where an enormous crowd has gathered in anticipation of the noontime swearing-in of the new president. We're joined by Ron Brownstein of Atlantic Media in Washington. Nell Irvin Painter joins us, professor emerita of history at Princeton University, author of Southern History Across the Color Line. Our own Jack Beatty is here. What is the meaning of this day for you, for the country, for African Americans, for all Americans? Here's Frank Xavier from Providence, Rhode Island, in Washington this morning, explaining why he was out at 5 a.m. this morning with his nephew.
It's the historic moment that we're here for, just to capture a part of our history that we're going to be able to share with our generations to come.
For generations to come, and a foreign visitor in Washington, D.C. today, reflecting on what he's seeing there.
Everybody in England is actually inspired by Mr. Obama, and just to be part of this occasion, it's historical. You never, ever have an opportunity again, so it's been great to get just to get here.
And a woman saying how she never imagined she would see the swearing-in of a black president.
Our moms came from Sparta, Georgia, traveled up to Connecticut. They were part of the misfortune of the Jim Crow laws. My mom was one of those people that did sit-ins once upon a time, and to see this great day come, it's beyond our imaginations, but we're thankful.
Beyond our imaginations, but we're thankful. On the Mall in Washington with us right now, my colleague reporter for WBUR, Monica Brady-Meyeroff. Monica, thanks for being there. Describe the scene around you, if you would.
Tom, it's packed. It's wall-to-wall people, and I'm about a mile from the Capitol building. And the crowd is young and old. It's mixed. I'd say it's predominantly African-American around where I'm standing. It's cold, but everybody has a very happy mood on despite the chill.
Now, these Jumbotron screens are all up and down the mall, 20-some of them. Is there any doubt everybody will have a view, even if on a huge screen, of the inauguration ceremony?
There are so many of them that everybody is not crowding toward it. So there, it isn't a crush because there are so many Jumbotrons, and you can probably hear the sound behind me. Some of the program has already started for those of us waiting on the mall for it to begin. And it's a very congenial atmosphere. And I met a woman on the mall just now, Sheila Moore from Virginia Beach, Virginia, and she came down here with her grandson. And let me turn the mic over to her to tell you why.
Wonderful. Thanks. Hello, Sheila. Sheila, are you there?
Yes, I am. This is a very historic moment for me. And the reason why I came from a segregated school to an integrated school, and now to see the first black Afro-American become president. I couldn't imagine a greater experience.
What do you think it will mean for your grandson there on the mall with you today? His life, his future, American life in his time.
Well, as he said, now he believes that he can become anything.
That's pretty powerful stuff.
Yes, it is.
Did you ever think you would see this in your lifetime, Ms. Moore?
No, I did not. I couldn't imagine this becoming a true fact in history in my daytime.
And when you stand on that mall, which you, as all Americans know or are learning in this inauguration, was once a slave market, when you look at that Capitol, built in no small part by African-American slaves, where does that history stand with you now? Is it passing? Is it still there, but on the other side of some historic line from this president?
Yes, it is very historical. It means that we are moving forward in our time and history.
It feels good to have emotion. Sheila Moore with your grandson. What's your grandson's name, ma'am?
Langston Elliott.
Langston Elliott. May he long remember this day, and thank you very much for joining us, Sheila.
Thank you.
Nell Irvin Painter, there's a voice from the mall, and thanks to Monica Brady Meyerhoff as well. Nell, there's a voice in the middle of the action in Washington, seeing a real turn in history. Do you feel the same way, Nell?
I do, of course. It's a kind of a watershed moment that we can point to. The changes have actually been visible since, for the last 10 years or so, in popular culture, in the way that Americans can envision themselves in advertisements and magazines and movies and so forth, a much more diverse America, in class terms as well as in race terms and gender terms. But this crystallizes it all. You can point to this very moment and say, look, we're different. Look, we're better.
Ron Brownstein, what are we expecting from Barack Obama today? This is the big moment. Some inaugural speeches disappear under the waves of history very quickly, but others leave phrases that we remember basically forever. Franklin Roosevelt, the only thing we have to fear is fear itself. JFK, speaking before Barack Obama was born, asked not what your country can do for you. And then, of course, Abraham Lincoln, in his reference to the better angels of our nature. What's known about what's coming or maybe coming from Barack Obama today?
Let me quickly say that just to amplify the previous point, not only is it an extraordinary day in American history, how many countries in the world have freely elected a leader who comes from a group that equals 12% of the population? It's really an extraordinary moment, not only in our own history, but in the history of the world. And it does reflect the changes we are living through. This was the first election in American history when less than 3/4 of the voters were white. And that number isn't going back up. It's only gonna go down. And Obama, I think, to a remarkable extent, embodies his coalition. I mean, he is a symbol of the change that in many ways has propelled him. Now, in answer to your question, I think, you know, we got a preview on Sunday in what was a terrific speech at the Lincoln Memorial during the We Are One concert, in which he basically talked about our responsibility to rise above many of our petty and partisan differences and find solutions, find common ground and build consensus on solutions to tackle the magnitude of the problems that we face. I think that you are going to, I would not be surprised to see echoes of that in the speech today. People have talked about how he likes to try out lines. And if Sunday was a dry run for today, it was really one of the better speeches I've seen from him in quite some time.
Jack Beatty, of course, you know, in many ways, Inauguration Day can be, it is almost by definition, a high point of anticipation, hope. He's got to then wade into this Capitol and into the problems, as Ron Brownstein said, enormous problems awaiting the next president of the United States, President Obama.
Enormous problems, but as Ron said, he has a sort of baseline. A success, even competence, is going to look like a great achievement, I think, for him. And he has a moment of concord across party lines. Whether he can translate that into consensus remains to be seen. But I hope that he holds on to the stories he's been hearing on the campaign trail. He repeats them often about people who've been hurting, and not just hurting in the downturn, but hurting even in the recovery. and that those moments, those people, those images can be the people he governs for. He talks a lot about social empathy, perhaps our only president yet to use that phrase. And if he could help us as a nation to look beyond our individualism at one another, and especially at the people that Theodore Roosevelt called the crushable elements beneath our civilization. If those people at the end of this presidency can have a better life because of something he did, legislation he passed, measures he pushed, then this will have been a successful and indeed one of the great progressive presidencies.
That would be a turn. Let's go to our listeners listening and watching along with us on this historic day in Charlottesville, Virginia. We're joined by Hobbs. Hobbs, you're on the air.
Hi there, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Good to have you. What are you thinking?
I just want to say briefly that I'm a 64-year-old man who grew up in Mobile, Alabama. I'm a proud Southerner. And my family lines, my mother's line is in Mobile, and my father's line is out of Charleston. It was a while as I was growing up in the what I now call the apartheid South that I came to understand that both Mobile and Charleston were very important slave importation points
yes.
in our country's history. And it took me a long while to digest the fact, which I really only came to in the last 10 years, that over those long generations, my family were small slaveholders. And so I have dedicated myself to locating the names of 132 slaves who were part of my family. I truly understand that. And I understand that while involuntary, they gave their labor to benefit my family.
Hobbs,
and
what does it mean to you against that backdrop, Hobbs? What does it mean to you to see Barack Obama sworn in today?
So I am so much honoring these members of my family and thankful, honored to be going to watch this inauguration here in Charlottesville, Virginia today. I worked hard for Mr. Obama, and I'm so proud of this moment in our nation's history.
Wow. A country moves forward, and Hobbs, you're a wonderful voice in that. Let's get another here. Thank you for calling. From Boston, Scotland, you're on the air.
Hi. I'm absolutely astounded and floored in every possible adjective you could use to describe this experience. As an African-American, someone who's running for office, I feel like I'm the new breed of politician. And also, more than that, what I really feel is that America is living up to its constitutional belief. This is the discourse of America, where we live up to what's in our Constitution. We're a living example for the rest of the world. These are one of the things that makes America great, because we have great moments like this throughout history. And it's not that we have to be great in every single day. But what we do is we always find a way to rise up over adversity and do things that have never been done before. And this is just another example of that in American history. And it's beautiful to be here. I love America. God bless America, the people around the world. And God bless Obama and the family. May they have the best presidency ever. He's an intellectual, and I'm honored to be part of this moment in life.
Making it real, the U.S. Constitution in Washington today. And thank you very much for your call. Let's get one more here from Cynthia in Ipswich, Massachusetts. Cynthia, you're on the air.
The thing that I wanted to mention when you talked about how we got here, I think that, you know, we've seen as a country so much financial difficulty, so much international difficulty, you know, with so much, you know, difficulty with hurricanes and things that have really kind of rocked us. You know, there's a great feeling of estrangement and disillusionment. But the thing about that is that I think from that comes a degree of clarity, you know, and a thirst for change. In those moments of clarity, you really start to look for what's closest in your heart, you know, what's the best for your family, for your town, for your country, you know. You're mm-hmm. looking for the most positive, powerful, intelligent person to run the country. You know, call me Pollyanna, but I really think that, you know, the renewable optimism and strength in this country is a tangible thing right now. And I think that is what really transcends race. And I think that's what got us to Obama.
Cynthia, thank you very much for your call, for all these callers. Nell Irvin Painter, a sense in a way with all the difficulties Ron Brownstein describes us facing, in a way that the country's been scraped clean, a kind of a, I don't know, a clean slate certainly is the right word. There's a lot on the slate, but a sense of shrugging off some of what has accumulated in terms of attitudes that may have been in the way of addressing this new century?
Yeah, absolutely. I don't think we should underestimate George W. Bush's contribution. He kind of scraped it all away. There was a little competence, a lot of offices left open, bungling, lying. I won't go down there. But anyway, I think George W. Bush did make this moment possible. But if I may, I'd like to go back to a point that Scotland from Boston made.
Yes.
About our Constitution. And that has to do with the starring role of Abraham Lincoln. We really have two constitutions. One is the original Constitution, which didn't utter the word slave or slavery, but which let it in and provided the scaffolding for its continuation until a war brought it to an end. So the original Constitution is a pro-slavery or condoned slavery constitution. The second constitution is the Reconstruction Constitution, the constitution that Abraham Lincoln made possible. And that is the constitution of the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments, which is the open constitution that talks about equal access and rights. That's the constitution that we actually live under. So maybe Barack Obama is not going to talk about Reconstruction, but by making Abraham Lincoln so important, he brings in the Civil War and he brings in the changes that that war wrought on our polity.
Ron Brownstein, Barack Obama has, attached himself to Abraham Lincoln and his fact and his myth like no president or candidate I can recall ever in my lifetime. Not Martin Luther King, but Abraham Lincoln. What do you make of that? You hear Nelevin Painter's observation, Ron.
Well, first of all, I often find that many presidents, at least, like reading about Lincoln because it reassures them that however bad they have it, somebody had it worse, had a more difficult challenge to face. I think that Obama finds, first of all, resonance in Lincoln's love of language and this terrific book that Fred Kaplan wrote, Lincoln Biography of a Writer, that came out recently, talking about what Lincoln read over his life and his belief in language as a way of changing hearts and minds. And I think Obama shares that, and certainly as a senator rather than a governor and as a relatively new figure, all of our dominant images of Obama really revolve around words and speeches. And I think he shares that. I think also he understands that this is a moment of obviously not we are not taking up arms against each other, but we have been locked in what I did call in a book a metaphoric second civil war. And mm-hmm. he is someone who, from the beginning of his career on the national stage, and even before that, when we read about him at Harvard Law School, has always saw himself as a healer of divides and a bridger of divides. And I think in both of those ways, the use of language and the desire to be a unifying figure. I mean, we remember Lincoln's great second inaugural, probably the greatest speech ever delivered by an American president, talking about the Civil War as a shared verdict of North and South for the sin of slavery, and really looking at all Americans under a common lens. I think those are areas where he sees a commonality with Lincoln, while having the humility to understand that we are not likely to see another Lincoln.
An instinct to build bridges in this president-elect, very soon to be president. But of course, then Lincoln went to war, Jack.
He did, reluctantly. And I think there's another aspect of Lincoln that you can see in here, and that is his logic and his pragmatism. Lincoln was a very clear thinker. He boiled things down to their essence. And he was a very practical thinker. He saw policies and programs in terms of results, not just the rhetoric. There was no cant about him. And there is that in Obama. He doesn't have Lincoln's forensic drive. You don't sense he's parsing every word. But there is that idea about, just seeing results.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We are covering the inauguration day of Barack Obama, about to become the 44th president of the United States. Let's listen in to voices from Washington today, where an enormous crowd has gathered, stretching right down that two-mile-long mall in front of the West Portico, where Barack Obama will be sworn in at noon. Here's a woman talking about the emotions of the day.
It's like something that is from deep in your soul, that you are connected to him, and he's connected to all of us, and our hope is with him, and we're with him. And it's a wonderful, wonderful thing. It's just hard to describe. I think you just feel it.
And another.
This is a lifetime event, and I want to be part of history. I want to be able to tell my children that I was actually here, part of history.
Part of history on the mall today in Washington, the feelings and the celebration.
I never thought I'd see this in my lifetime. I grew up in the 60s, and, you know, just awesome experience. Never thought I'd see it. I'm thrilled. I'm excited. I'm so happy to be here.
Ron Brownstein is with us from Washington, political director for Atlantic Media, author of The Second Civil War. Nell Irvin Painter is with us, professor emerita of history at Princeton University, author of Southern History Across the Color Line and Creating Black Americans. Jack Beatty's here as well. Let's go to our listeners. So many want to join this day. Jamil is calling from Boston. Jamil, you're on the air.
Good morning. I think almost importantly, far beyond the racial issue, there are two, three very important things. To me, Obama is a Renaissance person, not just an African-American, but a worldly person, which has been facilitated, obviously, by his educational experiences, but also he has inculcated into that the kind of thinking, the kind of appointments he's making. Secondly, I think at a time when America's reputation overseas was significantly tarnished, I think that the world would look again to America as a leader, as a beacon of light, of freedom for many people. And in my opinion, what is happening today in Washington, or to happen soon, is highly unlikely to happen in any European country, in most countries of the world. And I think that's very poignant. Lastly, in comparison to some European immigrants who come here, people like me, I come from Baghdad, Iraq, where I had my initial medical training. I think it's very important for other populations to see in this day what America can provide hope and for their aspirations, no matter where they come from, no matter how qualified or unqualified they are. I think these are very important worldly issues, which actually even accentuate the racial, you know, the fact that this is not only a breakthrough for this nation, but I think, in my opinion, a beginning of a new era for the world. Thank you.
Jamil, thank you very much for your call. Jamil, originally from Baghdad. Ron Brownstein, what about the message of this man taking this oath to lead this country to the world? How do you see that, Ron?
Well, I think that was a profound point. As I said before, there are very few, not only in American history, there are very few countries in the world that have freely elected a leader from a group that represented 12% of the population. It hasn't happened that often. And I think that Obama is a symbol of the renewal, in effect, of America's promise of opening its arms to the world and being inclusive and being a place where people from all over can come and, in effect, become Americans. Now, that's sort of at the symbolic level. At the practical level, I mean, Barack Obama is a global celebrity of a magnitude we have probably never seen before. And, you know, maybe John F. Kennedy would have been a comparable figure if he lived in our current media age. But Obama has enormous goodwill around the globe. And that does provide him and us some leverage as a means of trying to advance our own goals and to bring others along to our purposes. He has talked about working more closely with allies. He will also have, I think, through his popularity, more leverage on allies than typical presidents. And it will be interesting to see how that plays out. But there's no doubt that we have a U.S. president who is probably going to be as kinetic a figure around the world as any since Kennedy, and even more so because of the way the media now works.
Nell Irvin Painter, a sense that after a period in which the United States was seen as rigid, here we sort of bust out and show American flexibility in a way that you can't help but see. I mean, on the streets of Jakarta, they're serving Obama rice today, I'm reading. They've got celebrations in Japan and you name it. I mean, this is showing something about the malleability of the American political soul.
Yeah, I would add to what Ron said about 12% of the population. That true, it's something very special for African Americans, but it's also something very special for Americans who prize intelligence and education and science, the reality-based community, Democrats, feminists. You know, we could go on and on and on. So there's a coalition there that undergirds the great attraction of Obama for people around the world. Yesterday, evidently, the Israelis withdrew from Gaza or completed their withdrawal from Gaza with an eye on Washington. And I think we're going to see more and more actions around the world related to Washington and the sense that there are new opportunities of engagement, of careful, thoughtful engagement. So I would see the worldwide acclamation as part of the applause for just seeing an intellectual in the White House.
Let's go to Kevin in Amherst, New Hampshire. Kevin, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hey, I just had a couple of points, and one of them was similar to what the last speaker just said, and that is I'm concerned a little bit that we focus so much on the first African-American president that it can dilute the individual's accomplishments all by itself. And if we are a colorblind society, it really is accomplishments all by itself. And my second point is this is actually the first African-American candidate, legitimate African-American candidate for president that has ever been posted. I mean, Jesse Jackson and Alan Keyes weren't even close. So we're really talking one for one here, 100% of a true African-American candidate becoming elected. So just want to get some thoughts.
Kevin, thank you so much, Kevin. Ron Brownstein, it is fascinating to note how Barack Obama himself lets his skin color and perhaps his family's, whatever it may mean, just speak for himself. He does not refer to it often. It is not a major direct subject for him. How do you expect him to carry that aspect of his life, the fact of his life, into the White House front?
I think it will continue in exactly that way. The caller's point, I think, is correct. First of all, I think for the rest of the fact that he is African American in many ways, for the rest of the world, I think many people did not expect the United States could transcend color, and so it becomes even more remarkable for them. But it is absolutely right. I mean, he, as I said at the beginning, built a broader coalition than any Democratic candidate since World War II, except Lyndon Johnson. He got almost 53% of the vote. He won 9 states that President Bush won last time, including 71 both times. He didn't do that only because African American turnout notched up a little bit, and he moved up to 95% of the vote. He attracted a broad range, a very specific coalition. He dominated with Hispanic voters, with young voters, and did very well with college-educated white voters all across the country except the South, while still struggling with those blue-collar whites. I think that you will see him not only speak to that coalition, but every indication we have is that he will try to reach beyond it. I mean, everything that he has done, from honoring John McCain and talking to him to inviting Rick Warren, shows that he is, in a good sense, politically greedy. He is not satisfied just placating the people who elected him. He really does want to be, obviously it can't fully be done, but he aspires to be president of all the people, and at least in these initial gestures. Now, whether he fully follows that in policy, we'll see. But he has an outward bearing, I think. He has a kind of an expansive and inclusive instinct, which is, I believe, a better gyroscope as president than simply saying, you know, we are in this kind of trench warfare. I'm here to represent my side against the other. Enormous opportunity for him in the sense that there are a lot of people out there who didn't vote for him, as well as those who did, who are open to him. All of the polling suggests that. And so far, I think he is trying to speak to them as well as to his own core supporters.
Ron, we have now seen Vice President Dick Cheney headed to the Capitol building and the portico in a wheelchair. He pulled his back out, we're told, moving out of the vice presidential quarters yesterday, carrying a box out there. Makes us think of the Republican Party, Republicans on this day, many graciously welcoming this president. Nevertheless, there's been very tough
but they're
resistance.
In a wheelchair.
Well, I'm not going that far, but there's Cheney. Ron, I know we have to let you go in just a second. How deep the readiness in the GOP do you see to open a door, a window to a new kind of politics and really test out running with it with President Obama?
Boy, metaphor alert.
Yes, sorry.
I think the answer is that they are split, but by and large, they are not yet ready. The paradox Republicans face is that after these last two elections, 2006 and 2008, disproportionately the severe losses they've suffered have been concentrated among moderates and swing state senators. So what you've got left is a pretty, in this shrunken number in both the House and the Senate, you have a conservative core that dominates. In the Senate, if they end up with 41 seats, Tom, 26 of them will be either from the South or the Northern Rockies, the most conservative parts of the country. And what that means is there are very few people who have an instinct for what it takes to rebuild the party in the places where they have been routed in the Bush years, the West Coast, the Northeast, the Upper Midwest, these more cosmopolitan parts of the country. They are in a kind of contracting spiral at the moment where, as the party has been reduced, the influence of those who really are driving it away from the appeal in the places where they were treating increases. So it's not clear what turns that around. Democrats had to go through three straight wipeouts in the 1980s before you got a candidate in Bill Clinton who explicitly said we have to reformulate our agenda to reach people who are no longer looking at us. Republicans are not quite there yet, and I think it's going to be a wrenching struggle for them to reach that point. But I ultimately believe it is necessary. Right now, the great advantage of Democrats is perhaps a final thought. Not only Barack Obama, but at the congressional level, they are competing across a much broader geographic and demographic range than Republicans, who right now are having trouble reaching voters beyond those core cultural conservatives in the South and parts of the interior of the country.
Ron Brownstein, author of The Second Civil War, political director at Atlantic Media in Washington. Ron, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you. Thank you.
Let's get a call from Travis in Lincoln, Rhode Island. Travis, you're on the air.
Yes, Tom. I was just thinking about today's, the events and a poem for today, and I couldn't help but not have in my mind Langston Hughes's, Let America Be America Again. And just that one line, oh yes, I say it plain, and America was never America to me, and yet I swear this oath, America will be.
It's beautiful and a great line for the day, Travis. We appreciate it. Thank you very much for sharing it. Let's get one more here from Thomas in Boston. Thomas, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. I've traveled widely in Europe and the U.S., and I just can't help make a comparison to Princess Diana's state funeral in London about 10 years ago.
Comparing in what respect, Thomas?
Well, just this huge outpouring of emotion that sometimes it's so deep it can't be explained, and it's just a good thing to see. It's a positive thing and not a negative thing, somebody's death. And, you just can't but get dragged along with it. It's a great feeling.
Watching those enormous crowds, in this case, to celebrate, not to mourn, in Washington, and your mind is taken back to that day. Let's get one more here. Yuta in Marblehead, Massachusetts. Yuta, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hello to everybody. I just want to express how grateful I am for this day, for this new dawning. I was an 8-year-old child when the Second World War ended, and I lived through the Russian occupation of East Germany. I married an American. I was young. When I came to this country, I was 23. Now I'm 71 and a half, and I have 5 grandchildren. Mm-hmm. I am so grateful that this Barack Obama came to be in the White House. The freedom, the hope, the new dawning this brings, not just to us as Americans, this is a new way for the whole world. And I am deeply, deeply grateful that I can live this day, that I see this.
Yuta, we're grateful for your call. Jack Beatty, there's emotion. It's more than emotion. We've heard the reasons that people bring to bear, but yet how much does mood matter? It will be a different president, a different style, maybe different politics, but this mood today, how powerful is it in a nation's life?
Well, I think the media helps to magnify it, and I think the media, since so much of all of this is on television, they'll be running this, and they'll keep dipping back into it, and so I think it'll have a good long half-life. What I'm worried about is events. Again and again in the 20th century, waves of renewal and social progress have risen high only to break against the cruel rocks of war. The Progressive Era smashed by World War I, the New Deal by World War II, Harry Truman's Fair Deal by Korea, Lyndon Johnson's Great Society by Vietnam, and events. President, all of those presidents took time, you know, when they started their terms. Wilson said it would be an irony of fate if I had to, my administration came down to foreign affairs. Well, it would be an irony of cruel fate if this now progressive presidency, this attended with these high hopes, should face some foreign crisis that's out there. And again, you know, I mean, the thing, Barack Obama had the right idea in 1980, in 2002, when he said, we don't need this war. America doesn't need any wars. And I hope he holds to that when the people say to him, we have to bomb Iran or we have to, you know, ratchet things up in Afghanistan. I hope he remembers what happened in the 20th century.
Nell Evren Painter, a flash today, a sea change. We've just got half a minute, Nell.
It's a sea change that has been changing for the last 10 years. I think that what we've seen in the past 10 years will continue. We will be a country that celebrates its diversity, and we'll see different faces in different places and a sense of inclusion and reaching out and of intellectual grandeur.
Let us hope for that. Nell Evren Painter, Professor Emerita of History at Princeton University, thank you so much for being with us on this historic day. Thanks for joining us. And Jack, thank you for being here as well. We will be back at 7 p.m. Eastern Time with a live inaugural special. If your station around the country doesn't carry us at that time in the evening, you can listen online at our website, onpointradio.org. Immediately after Barack Obama's inaugural address, join Jack Beatty and me live for an online discussion. We'll share our reflections and take your questions. For the link, again, go to our website, onpointradio.org. Right after the inaugural today, we go out with the San Francisco Youth Choirs rehearsing this morning for the inauguration of Barack Obama. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.